The northern region, in more ways than one, was at the top. This was exemplified quite well by the map in the Ottawa office of Vice Coordinator Hiram McKenzie, in which the North Pole was centered. Except for the enclave of Europe with its Scandinavian and Icelandic regions, all the Arctic area was within the northern region. Roughly, it could be divided into two major areas. To the left on the map was all of North America above the Rio Grande. To the right was included all of what had once been the Soviet Union. Together, these areas represented the centered power of the planet in the first years of the atomic age. Between the two was Great Britain, a tongue of the region licking at Europe. Up at the top of the map, distorted into odd, huge shapes, were Australia and New Zealand, also member provinces of the region. Not all the changes of the past decades had yet altered the fact that the North was the economic ruler of the planet. There was almost an ostentatious symbolism thereof in the fact that of the official regional maps Byerly had seen, Mackenzie's alone showed all the earth, as though the North feared no competition and needed no favoritism to point up its preeminence. "Impossible," said Mackenzie, dourly, over the whiskey. "Mr. Byerly, you have had no training as a robot technician, I believe."
"No, I have not."
Well, it is, in my opinion, a sad thing that Ching, Ngoma, and Sejachowska haven't either. There is too prevalent an opinion among the peoples of Earth that a coordinator need only be a capable organizer, a broad generalizer, and an amiable person. These days he should know his robotics as well. No offense intended.
None taken. I agree with you.
I take it, for instance, from what you have said already, that you worry about the recent trifling dislocation in world economy. I don't know what you suspect, but it has happened in the past that people, who should have known better, wondered what would happen if false data were fed into the machine.
And what would happen, Mr. Mackenzie?
Well, the Scotsman shifted his weight and sighed. All collected data goes through a complicated screening system which involves both human and mechanical checking, so that the problem is not likely to arise. But let us ignore that. Humans are fallible, also corruptible, and ordinary mechanical devices are liable to mechanical failure. The real point of the matter is that what we call a wrong datum is one which is inconsistent with all other known data. It is our only criterion of right and wrong. It is the machines as well. Order it, for instance, to direct agricultural activity on the basis of an average July temperature in Iowa of 57 degrees Fahrenheit. It won't accept that. It will not give an answer. Not that it has any prejudice against that particular temperature, or that an answer is impossible, but because in the light of all the other data fed it over a period of years, it knows that the probability of an average July temperature of 57 is virtually nil. It rejects that datum. The only way a wrong datum can be forced on the machine is to include it as part of a self-consistent whole, all of which is subtly wrong in a manner either too delicate for the machine to detect or outside the machine's experience. The former is beyond human capacity, and the latter is almost so, and is becoming more nearly so as the machine's experience increases by the second. Stephen Byerly placed two fingers to the bridge of his nose.
Then the machine cannot be tampered with.
And how do you account for recent errors, then?
My dear Byerly, I see that you instinctively follow that great error, that the machine knows all. Let me cite you a case from my personal experience. The cotton industry engages experienced buyers who purchase cotton. Their procedure is to pull a tuft of cotton out of a random bale of a lot. They will look at that tuft and feel it, tease it out, listen to the crackling, perhaps, as they do, touch it with their tongue, and through this procedure they will determine the class of cotton the bales represent. There are about a dozen such classes. As a result of their decisions, purchases are made at certain prices, blends are made in certain proportions. Now, these buyers cannot yet be replaced by the machine.
Why not? Surely the data involved is not too complicated for it.
Probably not. But what data is this you refer to? No textile chemist knows exactly what it is that the buyer tests when he feels a tuft of cotton. Presumably there's the average length of the threads, their feel, the extent and nature of their slickness, the way they hang together, and so on. Several dozen items subconsciously weighed out of years of experience. But the quantitative nature of these tests is not known. Maybe even the very nature of some of them is not known. So we have nothing to feed the machine. Nor can the buyers explain their own judgment. They can only say, well, look at it. Can't you tell it's class such and such? I see. There are innumerable cases like that. The machine is only a tool, after all, which can help humanity progress faster by taking some of the burdens of calculations and interpretations off its back. The task of the human brain remains what it has always been, that of discovering new data to be analyzed and of devising new concepts to be tested. A pity the Society for Humanity won't understand that. They are against the machine? They would be against mathematics or against the art of writing if they had lived at the appropriate time. These reactionaries of the society claim the machine robs man of his soul. I notice that capable men are still at a premium in our society. We still need the man who is intelligent enough to think of the proper questions to ask. Perhaps if we could find enough of such, these dislocations you worry about, Coordinator, wouldn't occur. Earth, including the uninhabited continent, Antarctica. A. Area, 54 million square miles, land surface. B. Population, 3,300,000,000. C. Capital, New York.